Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Robert Rosenthal, Executive Director of the Center for Investigative Reporting, and your moderator for this evening's program. This program is being held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Middle East Forum. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org or download our iPhone and Android app for program and schedule information and podcasts of past programs. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished guest, Karen Elliott House, former diplomatic correspondent and former publisher of the Wall Street Journal and author of the new book on Saudi Arabia, Its People, Past Religions, Fault Lines, and Future. I've read this book, and it's an excellent book, and I learned more than I ever could have imagined about Saudi Arabia. And it was remarkable to me reading it. In the preface of the book, Ms. House describes how she came from Matador, Texas, a tiny town of maybe 700 people in Motley County, Texas, a great name, and how, as she grew up in this community, the county was dry, there was no alcohol. She grew up in a very sort of religious family, almost similarities throughout the book in terms of the structure and really the rigidity of her childhood really are remarkable in terms of how she had this connection, which if you read this book, you'll see to Saudi Arabia and how she's able to explain it. She left there and became a very distinguished journalist. She also won the Pulitzer Prize in 1984 in international reporting. And it's my pleasure to introduce her. And another thing, I'm also a journalist, and it's pretty remarkable when someone goes from being a young reporter to a publisher, and I don't know if she'll talk about that tonight, but it's a pretty remarkable journey. So please welcome Karen Elliott House.
Thank you very much. It's a real pleasure to have the opportunity to talk to all of you about Saudi Arabia, which I like to say is the strangest country you'll probably never see. It's so different from our own. I think that's part of what intrigued me and kept me going there over a 30-year period and intensively for the last 5 years. It's a country in which a woman never reaches an age of maturity, in which, because of gender segregation, she can never go to her son's school or see any of his school activities or see him graduate. Fathers obviously cannot see their daughters for the same reasons. And as you all know, she can't drive and she can't appear in public without her long black abaya. And where in extreme cases, obviously, women are in essence chattel for men to do what they wish with. It's a religiously dominated society in which men obey Allah and women obey men. And fortunately for men, Allah is very distant. Unfortunately for women, men are very close at hand. As Robert said, it was less strange to me in a way because of my background. Religion was the primary entertainment in my hometown. We had four churches and one blinking stoplight. No movie theaters like Saudi Arabia. My father was a very authoritarian father, where we all, ours was not to reason why, ours was but to do or die. Not quite that grim, but no alcohol, no dancing, no dice, no shorts, no pants. So going to Saudi Arabia was not so strange. for me. I had gone there beginning in 1978 as the diplomatic correspondent for the journal and continued to go over much of the next 30 years, but always to see government officials to talk about Arab-Israeli, Iraq-Iran war, U.S.-Saudi weapons purchases, so geopolitical things. And when I retired as publisher of the journal in 2006, the one thing I really wanted to do was see if I could understand and describe Saudi society. And my interest was in what you could learn, if you could do that, about Saudi stability, since this country is the source of oil for the Western world to sustain the Western way of life, and it is the source of the religious fundamentalism and the jihadists who would like to destroy that way of life. So I set out to see if I could really get around the country. And obviously, if you were going to try to write a book about American society, you couldn't go just to New York and Washington. So even though 80% of the population of Saudi Arabia lives in three cities, Jeddah, Riyadh, and Dammam in the eastern province where the oil is, I wanted to be able to go all over the country, and I did succeed at that because after the first year, they gave me a 5-year visa. So I was no longer dependent on each time I wanted to go getting a visa and dealing with the Ministry of Information. I was able to take a cell phone, rent a car, and pretty much go where I wanted to go. And it is a big advantage to be a woman in Saudi Arabia, contrary to what most people think, because to be an American woman, it's not a big advantage to be a Saudi woman. But Western women are fundamentally treated like honorary men. So men will talk to you, and you can see women, whereas the conservative women in the society obviously would not be willing to deal with someone like Robert or any other man, you know, that their husbands don't approve of mixing with people they're not related to. So I want to talk to, I did succeed in getting all over the country and talking to princes and poor people and women and men and young people and old people and indeed, in the end, even some of the senior religious people, which is where I had assumed it would be a problem being a woman. So I want to talk first today about some of the observations about Saudi society and then what those portend about stability or vulnerability of the country. And then lastly, about some scenarios that I think U.S. policymakers may face. The society is much more diverse than we think, very divided and very dependent. We think of Saudis as being very rich, but there are many poor people. 40% of the population lives on less than $1,000 a month, and 60% of the population is under 20 years of age. And 40% of the people aged 20 to 24 are unemployed. So they do have a restless youth problem. The divisions in the country are also very deep. It's divided by region. It's divided by tribe. It's obviously divided by gender. It's divided by religious sect. And people distrust each other, so they tend to stay within their own family or within their a close circle of relatives and do not mix much. Over and over, people would express great surprise to me. You've been to Tabuk, you've been to Dammam, you've been to Hail, naming different places, because they don't move around their own country much. the way we do. We in Texas always thought California was strange, but we still came here. Now, of course, the Arabs also come here. The Saudis, in particular, they do travel outside the country, but they do not travel a lot inside the country. So fundamentally, people are like those sets of Russian dolls, those nests of dolls. The individual is a little thing inside his family, inside his tribe, inside the religious establishment, inside the royal family, over all of it. And thus, people are a bit like mummies. They are bound tightly in the wrappings of tradition and religion and don't take much personal responsibility for what they do. Your family tells you what to do. They guide you, and you pretty much go. But the society is changing, in my view, rather rapidly because the walls that people literally live behind. People live behind 10, 12 feet walls. Your house is surrounded so that people cannot see in and so that your women will not be seen if they are walking around their lawn. That those walls that people literally live behind and figuratively behind even higher ones are being bombarded now by the internet, by satellite TV, by social media. When I started going in 1978, there was one Saudi channel, and it basically showed prayer all day long. And now you can see not just a visitor in a hotel, any Saudi will have a TV unless they religiously choose not to see everything, and many do. You can see you can see Fox, Discovery, CNN, MSNBC, Egyptian TV, Jordanian. You can't see Israeli TV, but you can see virtually everything else. So young people know a lot more about what's going on, and they are hearing other interpretations of religion aside from the Wahhabi version that is preached by their own religious establishment. And they are listening to other interpretations of religion. The society basically has three pillars of stability. The religious establishment, which is kind of 20 senior religious scholars who decide what's right and wrong on everything. And that is propagated down through universities, high schools, and 70,000 mosques across the country. That is the only social or civil organization in the kingdom. There are no clubs, no, you belong to nothing other than your mosque. Each of these pillars, the religious establishment, the royal family, and oil wealth, are showing signs of strain. I'll start with the religious establishment because religion is the most important entity in the kingdom. Young people are seeing the gap between the way religion is preached and practiced. It is wrong, for instance. It is preached for men and women who are not related to mix, and the religious police roam the streets enforcing this on people like me, but on Saudis especially. And yet the king has started a big new university outside of Jeddah called the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology, that he personally endowed with an endowment said to be second only to that of Harvard, where Saudi men and women mix with foreign men and women. And when one of these senior religious scholars was asked on a TV program, is this proper? He said, no, it's wrong. And the king fired him. And all the other, or many of the other ulama, some just kept their mouth shut, but some began to discover that the Prophet had had his hair washed by women and maybe it's okay. So they gave a pass to the king, but they don't give a pass to the rest of society. So these kind of things are eroding the credibility of the religious establishment, who many people see as being more interested in doing the will of Abdullah than of Allah. And to try to understand this religious life, I lived with a very religious lady named Lulwa, nicknamed Lulu. And she had translated for me several times at dinners with an imam's wife and sisters and mother. And so I asked her, you know, I'd like to really see what life is like. So she invited me. Her intent was to convert me. My intent was to see what life was like. And she welcomed me in the wall that was about as high around her house as this line here around the wall. And as we went upstairs, she said, she lives down here, meaning wife number one, and I live up here. She was wife number two. She had seven children. The first wife had eight children. And when her husband, who was downstairs one day and upstairs the next and up and down in a continuous rotation, when he came up, I had to go in my room and stay because obviously it would not be proper for him to encounter me. He knew I was there, but I was never introduced to him. She had a television, but she got only the religious channel, which does not show any women on that channel, because she did not want her sons, obviously, to ever see the face of a woman who was not a relative. And Saudi State TV does now. This is one of the changes of the last half dozen so years, does have anchor women who cover their heads but do not cover their faces, which is very controversial with people like Lulu. She represents a big swath of Saudi Arabia. I asked her, do you think you're a majority? She said, no, I'm not a majority anymore, and I think she's right. She's not. But her whole goal is to get her family to paradise. She had no interest in driving, no interest in anything other than righteous living. And at least in her case, she actually practiced what she preached. And I asked her 19-year-old daughter one day, how do you think your life will be different from your mother's? And she said, my mother is doing everything possible to make sure that my life is exactly like hers. There's probably no American daughter, certainly not my 17-year-old, who would say that with pride as opposed to sarcasm. So anyway, this new information that people have is eroding the religious establishment and undermining its credibility. And that's important because it is the religious establishment that gives credibility to the Al Saud family. Its purpose is to say these people are the legitimate propagators of the one true religion. Because otherwise the Al Saud are just another tribe. Oil wealth is the second pillar that does have cracks, because despite many, many years of five-year plans, oil is still the basic source of revenue in the kingdom. 90% of their treasury comes from oil, because they don't tax anything, because they have the opposite view. We had no taxation without representation. They have the view no representation without taxation. And so they don't tax, and therefore you don't get any representation. but people are consuming more and more oil domestically. So even Saudis have begun to worry about what happens if we don't have enough oil to export. And there are some that are beginning to ask questions about what will happen if the U.S. does become more self-sufficient. If the U.S., as predicted, is producing 10 million barrels a day, putting it on a par with Russia and Saudi Arabia. And because this oil wealth is fundamentally what is the regime uses to buy acquiescence of people, education is free, healthcare is free, it is no longer high quality because the population has expanded so fast over the last 30 years. There are now 20 million Saudis. If you want quality health care, you go beg a prince to get you into one of the military hospitals or the royal hospitals. But the money is used to provide a minimum standard of living. And lastly, the royal family itself, I think, is the biggest issue because this is a family that has ruled Arabia off and on for the last 250 years. It was thrown out once by the Ottoman allies and once by infighting among itself. And this third and last Saudi state, which was born, declared in 1932, by a man named Abdulaziz Al Saud, or Ibn Saud, as he was called. When he died, he had fathered 44 sons by 22 wives, and 36 of those boys lived to adulthood. So when he died in 1953, his eldest son succeeded him, and it has since passed from brother to brother across this 36 surviving brothers. King Abdullah is only the fifth of those brothers to be king, but at 90 now, many of them have died, obviously, and the youngest surviving brother is 68. The king has already, in his 7 years on the throne, outlived two crown princes. He's on his third. So it's very much like the old Soviet Union in the 80s, when Brezhnev died, followed by half-dead Andropov, who was quickly followed by half-dead Chernenko, who was finally followed by Gorbachev. But by the time he got there, there wasn't time to save the country. So they have not been able as a family to agree as this line runs out, and they can all see it running out. They can't agree on a son of any of them yet. And they just recently, which underscores this inability to agree, named as third in line this youngest son, who for 30 years of my going there, I met him 25 years ago when he was governor of a province, but everyone has said he can never be king because his mother is a Yemeni, not a Saudi. But he's now in line. He maybe still won't be, but to me that simply underscores the difficulty they're having agreeing on a younger man. What do Saudis want? They do not talk a lot about democracy because obviously they have no real experience whatsoever with it. They say they want greater accountability by the government, more transparency about how the money is spent, because much of the money is never accounted for. You see the budget for what is spent, but that's a fraction of what everybody can calculate comes in if they multiply oil exports times $100 a barrel, which they're all capable of doing. And they say they want justice, by which they mean, say they mean laws that are clearly enforced and enforced equally on everyone. I spent a lot of time on car theft, for example, to look at the law. And the police, if your car is stolen, don't really do anything about it unless it's gone for at least a week, because the people who steal cars are mostly stealing them for fun. So they're wealthier children, not poor people. And they simply steal the cars and race them, sometimes wreck them. But it's a high class crime, shall we say. So the police frequently don't like to arrest poor car thieves, and there are some, because they say the rich kids get off and the poor kids don't. So there's a lot of people in that sense taking the law into their own hands. Lastly, I will just talk a minute about scenarios. The country is very sclerotic now, not just the geriatric leadership, but the economy too. 90% of the employees in the private sector are foreigners. Saudis work for the government or they don't work. So it's not an economy that that is very efficient or makes a lot of sense. The government is putting enormous pressure on people to hire Saudis, but that's not happening. And Saudis don't particularly, they don't want to do menial jobs. They simply don't. So when you check into a hotel, the doorman will be from Pakistan or Bangladesh. The guys behind the counter are probably from Lebanon, Egypt. There's always at least one Saudi behind the counter. But that tends to be it. So the status quo, I think, is the most likely, and the status quo means continued economic and social stagnation, with the ensuing risks of upheaval by frustrated young people. And even though Saudis tend to be quite passive, there is an enormous amount of communication online now among young Saudis. Another option, obviously, would be they get some younger prince as a ruler, and he does try to open up the economy a bit and relieve the stagnation and revitalize things, and that sets off a backlash among the conservatives, and it increases the demands among the modernizers, so that you have trouble. A third that most Saudis say cannot happen again is a reversion to the religious rigidity of the 80s and 90s. After the Shah came to power in Iran in 79, and a bunch of Saudi fundamentalists attacked and took over the mosque in Mecca, the royal family nervously fearful of religious conservatives basically turned the country over to them. They took women off TV. They shrouded them more. And after 20-plus years of that, they got 9-1-1 and the terrorists. So they realized they had made a pact with the devil. So they have been trying in the last half dozen years to have a kinder, gentler version of Islam. I will stop because I'm more interested in your questions, but my concluding analogy in the book, and I will simply conclude with it here too, is that a metaphor, that the kingdom is much like a big 747 flying with the cockpit full of geriatric pilots, first class full of would-be princes who would be king, economy full of frustrated young people, Islamic fundamentalists, and a terrorist here and there who would like to hijack the plane. And it continues to lose altitude slowly, and somewhere on board there is probably a team that could land it safely, and the issue is, will they get the opportunity to do so?
So the next...
Thanks.
So who wants to get on the plane? But our thanks to Karen Elliott House, the former diplomatic correspondent and former publisher of the Wall Street Journal and author of the new book, On Saudi Arabia, Its People, Past, Religion, Fault Lines, and Future. That ominous image of the plane in flight, as you said, is how you end the book. You've been to Saudi Arabia, I think, over 30 years. This book is very revelatory. Who did you actually... Do you think your audience was for this? And do you think maybe you've been welcomed back to Saudi Arabia, but have you any sense of the reaction to the book?
My audience was Americans. I wanted normal people to read it, you know, so not... I wasn't trying to write for a foreign policy audience. At the Journal, we always got taught that you must be credible to the expert and accessible to the non-expert. So I wanted to be credible to the foreign policy community, but accessible to, you know, just anybody with a curiosity about the country. So it's very anecdotal. It's full of people, but analysis. I tie all the anecdotes together. I have been back. I was back in January. I have no idea whether they will renew my visa when it expires next year. I have had one prince buy 50 copies and pass them out. He liked it. I've had another say I don't agree with anything in it, which I know is not an accurate statement because he's a source of much of the stuff in it. So I don't... I got interviewed by a big Arabic language newspaper in January, so I think I'm not persona non grata, but... I'm sure there are people, I think basically most Saudis probably have not read it because they are not a big reading society. And secondly, if they're going to read, they're going to read it in Arabic, and it's not going to come out in Arabic for several more months.
You describe religion as sort of a thick fog over Saudi Arabia, and in another part of the book, you talk about, which I found very interesting, sort of the passivity and lack of individuality. That's the hallmark of Saudi society and culture. Can you, talk about how you can, the linkage between the fog and the culture and nature of Saudi society?
Mm-hmm. Religion is so omnipresent. Every airport, every shopping mall, every government building, every school has prayer rugs, you know, lined up where people pray five times a day. Now, some of the prayers obviously do not occur during the workday, but if you're in a restaurant, I was having dinner with a Saudi businesswoman, and when it came prayer time, she excused herself and went to pray. If you're in someone's office, most of the time they will excuse themselves and go pray. So for some people it's ritual, but there is I found people actually, other than the religious scholars, not that adept at discussing their religion, because I think it, for most people, it is like, you know, when you're born, your mother puts a diaper on you, and then eventually you're able to put your own underwear on, but it's, you don't think about it, you just do it. And I think it's it is a bit of a habit for a lot of people, which is not to say they, you know, they don't believe in God, but they're not a questioning people. And professors say this about their students. The religion teaches you not to question. And particularly the Wahhabi version teaches you that you must not, you must obey the ruler, because to cause chaos is a terrible thing. And that's what you're taught in every venue, really. So obedience is something that you're trained to do, and because you don't question things, you simply tend to be passive and go along. They have a joke. I mean, Saudis have a sense of humor, and they have a joke about their passivity, which I put in the book. The king wanted to find out sort of the limits of this, so he set up a roadblock, and he asked people for their he stopped them. Nobody said a word. So then he had the policeman the next day stop the car and ask for a driver's license. Nobody said a word. The lines get longer and longer. So he then said, all right, stop them, ask for the driver's license, and slap the driver. And finally, one guy went berserk. So they took him to the king, and he said, now, my son, tell me, you know, what upsets you? And he said, if you're going to do this, you could at least have two lines. And it is illustrative of the of their own ability to joke about their passivity.
How, in terms of the Wahhabi and the role of the Saudis see themselves, again, with the overlay of a religion in the Arab world and what's going on in their neighborhood, as you allude to in the book, with Yemen, Iran, Iraq, Somalia, and their surroundings, and the role of the Americans and the American support. What, I mean, in terms of the what we're dealing with now currently in the Middle East, what, you know, how do you see the Saudis positioning themselves and in light of also what's happening in Syria, which I don't think you address in the book, but clearly has to be really just sort of a crucial issue in how who they're supporting and how they're positioning themselves with regard to, especially to Iran.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Iran is really their major preoccupation, partly for religious reasons, because the Iranians are Shias and the Saudis, or the majority of Saudis, are Sunni. And so they really feel that these people are, they're far worse than Christians and Jews, because they're the wrong kind of Muslims. So Iran is their big occupation, or preoccupation, and they would like to knock off Assad in Syria because it would give Iran a black eye as his supporter and friend. So they are funding and providing weapons to the fighters in Syria. And they say, and you've probably all seen that Secretary of State Kerry is saying, well, this can be done without arms going into the wrong hands. I have my doubts. I think the Saudis, during these 5 years that I was intensively there working on the book, would constantly say, you know, you Americans, you wanted to get rid of Saddam because he was a nasty guy. And yes, he was a nasty guy, but you didn't think about what you were creating. You handed Iraq to Iran on a silver platter. I think they want to get rid of Assad because he's a nasty guy supported by Iran. But they are not thinking about what they're going to create. And some of these people may well come back to bite them and us.
Is that the view sort of from the government or the families, or what would the street view it? And tied into that, the whole issue, which I'm sure they're watching extremely closely and in a very interesting way, the dynamic between Israel and Iran on the nuclear issue.
The average Saudi says, you know, I'm sure anybody would be concerned about the level of human killing that's going on in Syria. So they say their concern in Syria is about the people. And I'm sure that that is true. I think their government is more concerned about, you know, one-upping Iran than I'm sure everybody cares that 70,000 Syrians have died thus far. But I think the Iranian angle is much bigger in the minds of the government, if not the minds of the Saudi people.
Okay. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Karen Elliott House, former publisher and former diplomatic correspondent for the Wall Street Journal, who is discussing her new book about the inner workings of Saudi Arabia. You can also find video of Commonwealth Club programs online at Fora TV. A lot of the questions we've gotten from the audience are about sort of how you actually went about your reporting. You mentioned that you were sort of an honorary man as a foreigner. But how do you actually arrange? I mean, obviously you had many years of contacts, but how do you arrange interviews? How did you travel? How did you do the interviews? And what were some of the obstacles you faced in doing this remarkable book?
Well, one of my slogans for life is persistence pays, and boy, did I have to persist. I started out with people I knew or, you know, had met over the 30 years saying, I want to do a book. I was always totally up front because their intelligence is so good that anything they wanted to know about what I was doing, they would have known. So I never tried to be coy. I started out with people saying, I'm trying to write a book about Saudi society. I want to talk to you about what's changed, because that was a wide open subject. So if I were talking to someone my age, I would say, what's changed in your lifetime? How are things different now than when you were a young person? How are your children's life? And, you know, I didn't push them. I let them lead me. And, you know, after a while, you start to hear some things repeated. And it was like putting together a 10,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. You have to start, you know, with one piece at a time, trying to line the colors up and see what the contrasts are, and then fill in the middle. And so every person I talked to, I would try to get them to introduce me to someone else, because Saudis are not, it's not a place you do man on the street interviews. Hi, I'm Karen Elliott House. I'd like to talk to you. You have to be taken by someone they trust, and then and the fact that I was going back month after month for 5 years was also very helpful, because you could see many people more than once. And somebody told me when I first started going to the Middle East, Arabs will tell you what you want to hear, so you have to make sure you don't indicate what you think about anything. And sometimes I notice that if somebody takes you to see someone, what that person says in the presence of the person who brought me is different from what they say if I get to go back the next time without that person. So basically, I tried to expand my circle of acquaintances, and everybody asked them, can you get me? I'd like to see this. I'd like to talk to car thieves. I'd like to see poor people. I'd like to visit universities. And, you know, once you do one university, then somebody connects you. In that sense, it wasn't that hard. It took a lot of time. And to get from one place to another, you know, sometimes whoever is introducing you to them, to whomever you're going to see, takes you. But you can rent a car and drive her at the hotel. You say, take me here, take me there, and they take you. You pay for it. That was one thing. Everyone in Saudi Arabia, because most people are taking money from someone, they all want to know who's funding you. That question would come up fairly quickly in almost every interview. And so I would explain, I have a book contract. The publisher gives me money to cover expenses. So I'm paying for myself. And the publisher provides the money. So the ultimate payer is the, is the publisher. It's an American publisher. Because people all want to know who you're beholden to.
Did you have to wear an abaya? And could you?
I did. I invested, actually for the Wall Street Journal, I did a story on a woman who makes, they're now very fancy abayas. Actually, this is funny. When I went back the first time for this book project, I took my old abaya, the one when I first started going in the early 70s, I didn't wear an abaya. It wasn't necessary. It was more normal then than in the 80s and 90s. But I had this black sort of silky thing that you wrapped around you. And so I showed up for an interview with a female economist, and I had my black thing wrapped around me, and she said, oh, my mother used to have one of those. And I went, so I went down to the local abaya store, and they now have very fancy ones with pretty decorations on them. I mean, you can get them subtle or very. And my religious lady I lived with told me how improper my abaya was because it fit across the shoulders. It was like a long coat, mine, and it had orange and blue braid on the sleeves here. And I kept the scarf around my neck. I didn't wear it except when the religious police came up to me once and said, cover your head, you're in Saudi Arabia. Or I went to see a judge in Qatif, a Shia town in the eastern province. He was a Sunni, or he wouldn't have been a judge, but he had forcibly separated a man and woman, a Shia and a Sunni couple. And so I was trying to discuss that with him, and he would not meet unless I was totally covered. And the lawyer, there was a lawyer with me who took me to see him. So once we got in, and I don't have a proper thing you tie around your face. I just covered myself with my scarf. And the lawyer said, you've got to let her show her face. You know, she's got to be able to see you. So he agreed. But, you know, if you go to see religious people, the senior scholars or something, you have to cover up. Because they don't want to, they want to maintain the rules, whether they want you to or not. Certainly, if you're writing a book about the country, they want you to.
The whole question, and it's not really a clear answer, is, you know, how much oil is there? And this question is sustainability. So I'm sure in the book you allude to that question and how the Saudis are dealing with it, and one of the issues they're facing is their own huge increase in consumption. Mm-hmm. But is there much research going on in solar power or any renewables or investment in technology? You write, I have to say that one of the things in the book that you write in a very positive way, as you use Armaco as an example, mm-hmm. of you can address that, mm-hmm. How that is different, almost an island of, I'm not sure normalcy is the right thing, but so the bigger question, though, is what are they doing in terms of really this question of long-term sustainability and this colossal wealth they've been able to build on the rest of the world paying for it?
Mm-hmm. They, as I discuss in the book, when the Americans were running Aramco up until the 80s, their estimates of oil reserves differ very much from what the Saudis then announced as the kingdom's oil reserves when they took over Aramco. And even though they've been pumping for the last 35 years, those reserves, by their numbers, haven't gone down. So one issue is, what are the reserves? But they are trying to do, they say they're going to build 16 nuclear plants to produce electricity so that they don't use valuable oil for generating electricity, and they do have a solar program. They have great plans for a lot of things, and a young man just wrote me a note saying, you know, they're really doing all of this right. They do have plans, and the people who run the plans are as smart as anybody you would ever want to meet. It's just that as it goes on down the line, not so much happens. But Aramco, to what he was referring to, I do mention in the book that, you know, Aramco is a perfect example of how Saudi Arabia could function. It's run by the Saudis. It has roughly 80% Saudi employees, or that's at least what they say. I have no reason not to believe it. They have women who work at Aramco. They are now giving young women scholarships abroad and to come back and take jobs at Aramco. It is an island, though. It is literally a fenced complex where Saudis and foreigners live together, Shias and Sunnis, men and women. And they do not have a mosque with a big minaret. They have services in a glass building. So it's everything about it is to observe the religion, but to function. And it's a meritocracy in the way that the rest of the country isn't. But it doesn't have much influence on the rest of the country, and I think King Abdullah's University will be the same kind of island. It is an island also where there's a movie theater and a mosque. The only movie theaters in the kingdom are at Aramco and Khaos. They're banned elsewhere. But they're both islands that don't really affect the way the rest of the country operates. I mean, the interesting thing will be how these 140,000 Saudi students the king has sent abroad, what impact they have on the country as they come back.
Let's go back to the role of women. I mean, there are some schools you talk about and colleges opening for women, and you interview the one woman who wants to be the judge, the attorney. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you think that's a sham? I mean, do you see that evolving? And the other thing you frame in the book is sort of the wasted intellect and resources of women who can help the society overall. Mm-hmm. I mean, where do you really see this going?
I think women are the wedge of change in the kingdom, because they've now been educated for 30 plus years. 60% of university graduates are women. You know, not unlike here, women try harder. They don't have as many opportunities as women here do. I mean, you can basically teach or be a doctor. And there are more things opening to them. But people like Lulu are very, very upset that the Saudi Minister of Labor is working to on the king's orders to create job opportunities for women. So women now sell lingerie. You can buy your intimate apparel from a woman instead of a Bangladeshi man now. They are working in cosmetic shops, and, you know, conservative people say this is the beginning of the end. You know, next thing you know, these women are going to be doing no telling what. But there are so many educated women now, and young women you meet in colleges and universities are very articulate, and you know, say they intend to work and have families. So I think things are changing.
One of the most striking lines in the book, you describe yourself as, this is a quote, exploring a museum of mummies rather than a living culture. Can you explain what you mean by that?
It's, again, the passivity bound point. And this is changing. Younger people are very different from their parents. They still don't question things as much as a young person here, because as I also try to explain in the book, here you're taught from the beginning, you can do anything you want, you can be anything you want, and parents try to encourage you to develop yourself, express yourself, and none of that, you know, happens there. So even if you manage to do that, the sheer act of breaking free from these rules leaves, I think, scars on you that don't occur for people here. But this idea that people are bound by tradition and they don't, you know, like Lulu, I mean, she just has no interest in anything different. But young people do. Even the students at Imam University, the premier religious university, I met with some guys there, and they were all doing what their fathers had told them to do. They were studying what their fathers had told them to do. But even those guys, if you ask them, so how do you handle religious issues? Who do you follow? You know, would say, I read the Quran and decide for myself. And that's a real, in my view, breakthrough to make decisions for yourself. Because Saudis, I met an interesting guy there who had studied religion here and there. And he said, you know, we're not responsible for what we do because our parents tell us what to do. So we don't have to take responsibility, which I found a very strange concept.
I think you were battling your feelings about strange throughout the whole book, but you did it in a masterful way. And here's another little factoid that sort of stopped me as reading this. There's AA in Saudi Arabia. You talk about a car thief who had to go to AA. How, in a place where alcohol and drugs are completely banned, obviously they exist, but there's AA?
Yeah, well, when I met him, he was nearly 40 years old. And for the first time in his life, he had a job. And his job was carrying papers around to bureaucracies. If you don't have time, you hire somebody to take your driver's license papers around and stand in line at different places. And he preferred to do that over something where he could have made more money. But he had been a car thief, and he got caught and several times and lashed, and while he was in prison got into drinking, and you know, so that landed him back in prison, but there are drugs and alcohol, and the papers now cover that all the time. I mean, one of the poor ladies I met, her husband was in prison for selling drugs. And she and her three boys had one bed. They all slept in the same bed. And she went to the prison once a month and took the husband a phone card so that he could call the children because he's allegedly away on a business trip. So for 3 years, this guy has been in prison calling his family, calling his children. I mean, she perpetuates this myth, and he takes her money, and she believes he's still using drugs in the prison, and he probably is. But it's, you know, all the vices that exist anywhere do exist there and are available. So people, it's not as prevalent among as many people as it is in this country, obviously, but it's available and does exist.
You mentioned earlier the issues within Islam, Shia, Sunni, but how does a culture where, and you talk about many times the infidels, any non-Muslim, how does a culture where this is sort of ingrained adjust to the outside world, whether you're talking about a Christian or a Jew or anyone else? I mean, you're obviously the huge change, one of the huge changes is technology and the internet, but how do you see Saudi Arabia coming out of this? Is it purely generational, or does the younger generation still have the feelings maybe that their elders have towards the rest of the world?
It varies very much from family to family. I mean, the people, like the lady I lived with, she's not going to go kill anybody, and she couldn't understand why I didn't convert. She asked me, so are you afraid when you go back home? Because she couldn't possibly think that, you know, there's anything about the religion that wouldn't be absolutely appealing. But young people do hear other views of religion, and the Wahhabi version is not what much of the Muslim world adopts. So, and you have even the king trying to tame the worst excesses of the religiosity. But, you know, the religious establishment likes its power and has a lot. And try to use it to if the royal family gets to be too liberal, they fear at least that the religious establishment can turn the people against them. So I think it will happen slowly, but there are a lot of young people who are exposed to other views of Islam, and some of them are buying it. Some of them, obviously, young people are would-be jihadists who are buying the most radical view of Islam. But I think that they are slowly, I do think they're slowly changing.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's only time for one last question, so I'll make it slightly personal, but you've had an incredibly distinguished career as a journalist, a foreign correspondent. I had to ask this question, but you've interviewed Saddam Hussein, you've interviewed the rulers, many of the rulers of Saudi Arabia, other people around the world, and especially in the Arab world. Is there a similarity, a character issue that you found in all these men, and they are all men, or dissimilarities in terms of your own sort of view of looking back at your time with them and what you wrote?
Mm. I'd say there are more dissimilarities. I mean, Saddam Hussein was and wanted you to believe he was the meanest man you had ever met. I mean, you know, most third world dictators want you to think they're good men. They're just misunderstood. I asked him, how do you like to be known as the butcher of Baghdad? And he said, it's important to be tough. I mean, he didn't say, oh, how can you say something like that about me? You know, whereas King Hussein of Jordan was one of the kindest, sweetest, you know, men ever. I went to his son's birthday party, and it was cold, and he went in the house himself and came out with shawls for all the 13 mothers of the children there with his child. You know, he didn't send somebody in. He was just so I think there are more dissimilarities, at least in my experience, than similarities.
Okay. Our thanks to Karen Elliott House, former diplomatic correspondent and former publisher of the Wall Street Journal, and author of the new book, On Saudi Arabia, Its People, Past, Religion, Fault Lines, and Future. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. This program has been held in association with the Commonwealth Club's Middle East Forum. We also want to remind everyone here that copies of Ms. House's book are on sale in the lobby, and she will be pleased to sign them in this room following the program. I'm Robert Rosenthal, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you very much.